WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Joining me now on Fresh Air is Jim McGowan, whose achievements have been an inspiration to many people. Now, at the age of 19, when he was heading for a career in baseball, Jim McGowan was attacked by a gang and stabbed. This left his legs paralyzed. It would be easy to see how an experience like this could leave someone feeling bitter and helpless. But Jim McGowan has been very active, very creative, and very successful. In the mid-1950s, he sang in the R&B group The Four Fellows. They had a number one hit record in 1955, that is, which was called Soldier Boy, and we're going to hear that a little later. From there, Jim went to college and eventually became a cytotechnologist. In addition to this lab work, he's written a book called The Life and Letters of Thomas Garrett, whose home in Wilmington was a station in the Underground Railroad. He's completed a book on the R&B singing of the 1950s, and he did the photography for a book called Wheelchair Champions, A History of Wheelchair Sports, which is published by Crowell. His initial reason for moving to Pennsylvania was to be near the Central Penn Wheelers. He's also organized a large wheelchair sporting event. Jim has also been very active in getting people to be responsive to the needs of the handicapped. Jim drove here today in a car that was specially designed for him, and I'm glad you made it here, Jim. Thanks.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here, I assure you.
A few months ago on the show, Bill Van Wert, who writes a lot about film, was here, and we were talking about movies, and he said when the movie Coming Home opened, they made a point of booking it into movie theaters that could not accommodate the handicapped because they were afraid that a lot of handicapped people, a lot of people in wheelchairs, would show up to see the movie. And if they did, if there are a lot of people in wheelchairs online, it would alienate, it would scare, it would make uncomfortable other people who'd want to see it, scare them away. Do you think that wheelchairs and people in wheelchairs make other people who aren't paralyzed uncomfortable?
Well, you ask really two questions in one. I'd like to comment on both. Actually, concerning the picture itself, for instance, if the purpose of the picture was to inform people concerning people in wheelchairs, then they were in contradiction with themselves if they showed the film in movies where people in wheelchairs couldn't get in. I mean, how can people learn about people in wheelchairs if they don't witness it firsthand? I mean, the picture may have brought out several. I didn't see the picture. This is why I'm more or less speculating. If they brought out certain ideas and aspects and feelings concerning people in wheelchairs, then they certainly would have had people in wheelchairs there so that people who were coming into the theater, able-bodied people that is, could have the experience. So I don't go along with that. I don't think that was the right thing to do. I mean, you have to move into personal contact with another person to be able to understand them and to be able to feel what that other person feels. Now, your other question is, do people in wheelchairs make able-bodied people feel uncomfortable? And the answer to that is quite simply, yes. I mean, if you've never been in a wheelchair, if you've never been paralyzed, you don't know what the experience is like, and so you're naturally going to feel uncomfortable. But this is human. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. You're going to feel uncomfortable. And again, this is where the movies could have certainly served a great purpose, that is, by letting these two groups get together. Now, I have had to go out of my way. Well, I won't say go out of my way. I've had to make an effort to reach out to other people to make them feel more relaxed around me.
So when you meet someone, you have to put them at ease.
That's true. I mean, I think it's a reciprocation that goes on. They have to make an effort to sort of communicate with me, and I have to make an effort to sort of communicate with them. And so the message really is for both the able-bodied and the person who is in the wheelchair. We have to reach out for each other.
What are some of the options that aren't really open to someone who is in a wheelchair? Is it easy to go to public places? Can you use public transportation? Can you see movies? Can you get into the movie theaters easily?
Well, no. Yes and no, let me say. Things are changing with the passing of the 504 regulations. I mean, the law has mandated that all buildings and publicly funded buildings anyway be made accessible for people in wheelchair and for the disabled in general. And so, things are changing. That is, movie houses and shopping centers and places like that are now being made accessible for people in wheelchairs. But at the same time, there's still old buildings and things like that that people in wheelchairs can't get into. And there are still a lot of old attitudes around that prevent people in wheelchairs from getting into the mainstream of life. And I mention attitudes because here was, here is a stark contradiction. Here is a movie that was designed to help promote a greater understanding of people in wheelchairs. And, of course, they still had the same attitude, which is that don't let the people in the wheelchairs be seen in front of the able-bodied person.
When you're going, say, to someone's house for dinner or something, there must be houses that you have trouble getting into.
That's true. I mean, I've had some interesting experiences like that. I've had some that have been absolutely hilarious. For instance, I have friends of mine who are always inviting me to the house to dinner. And, I mean, they're close friends. And I've gone to them. At their house, there's like 12 steps to get in. And when I go there, of course, I got to get out of my wheelchair. And I sit on the steps and I bump up backwards to get into the, to get up the steps while the husband of the, you know, holds my legs. One day I did that. I got up to the top step and my pants came down. Well, it was kind of embarrassing, but we had a, you know, we had a laugh about it. But the point is that, the, you know, buildings were built many years ago without taking the handicapped into consideration. And so there's many places where I just can't get in. There's many bathrooms that I just can't get in. But it doesn't stop me. I mean, we can always find a way to overcome these things. And so, I mean, if we're willing to go ahead and get out there and try to do the best we can always overcome those little problems.
You're probably in the position sometimes of knowing that you can get into a place if you just ask someone to help you do it. And you might be in a place alone, and that might mean asking a stranger to, you know, just help you get out of a chair or into a room or whatever. Is that easy or hard to do? Have you been in that position?
Yes, many times. As a matter of fact, I drove from here to Nova Scotia once by myself. And I did that on the basis of the fact that I knew that if I needed help, there would always be somebody there to help me. But the point is this, that you have to ask, you know, you have to ask people for assistance, okay? And there are certain things about that that, that we ought to bring to light, and that is that, for one thing, if a person who is disabled asks another person to help them, the person who they ask to help them should be aware that they should do what the disabled person tells them to do. Okay, many people, when they attempt to help a person who is in a wheelchair, do what they think should be best, and this is not. This can create more problems. Okay, I don't know whether I'm really specifically answering your question now. Am I doing all right?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. That is that. You know, I have been in positions many times where I had to ask for help, and you have to come out of yourself. The person who is disabled really has to come out of himself and be able to speak up and say, hey, I need help. Will you please help me? I feel certain that there's always someone around who would be willing to give assistance. The point is that the person who is willing to give the assistance really should ask, what is it that you want me to do? Don't just grab the wheelchair and do what you think you should do, because that really will create a problem. And the person who wants to help, that is the disabled person, should be willing to tell the person who is helping her or him what it is that they should do.
What do you look for in a person before you ask them for assistance?
Well, I don't know. I never thought of that. I usually ask the first person. Well, first of all, I usually don't need that much assistance. So I may be the exception and I may not. I would say this. Generally speaking, then people who are in wheelchairs travel by themselves. You can rest assured they generally know how to take care of themselves. But there are those instances where they do need help. And when that comes about, what do we look for? I suppose someone who is willing to do as you ask them to do. And you almost have to be psychic, I guess, to be able to figure that out, because you're meeting perfect strangers. If you can't find someone who you feel is that way, then you should have enough extroversion, shall we say, to come out of yourself to be able to tell them, hey, wait a minute, listen, I like your help. But please, will you do it the way I ask you to do it? That way you'll be helping me much more.
I think that probably because of the Vietnam War, there are a lot more people who are in wheelchairs now as a result of what they suffered while fighting. Do you think that that has had an effect on people's awareness of, you know, what it's like to be in a chair and what, you know, what kind of assistance you might need and what kinds of equipment or facilities a building needs to have to, you know, enable you to get into it and use the facilities?
Well, I tell you the truth. I don't have the statistics on this, but I don't know whether the Vietnam War really is the war that started this whole thing. I think it was the Second World War, to tell you the truth. Yeah, after the Second World War, many veterans came out of the hospital, and in the book that I did the photography for, History of Wheelchair Champions, we find that that's where it really all started. The veterans who came out of the Second World War, who were paralyzed, who were amputated, and were looking for things to do, these are the guys and the girls who developed wheelchair sports and developed a public awareness toward the people who were in wheelchairs. Now, this public awareness began to grow. And, of course, the Vietnam War was a very unpopular war. And after that, of course, I think it kind of caught on. I just think that the Vietnam War was something that came along right at the right time in terms of the disabled, you see. But I don't think that that was the war that really started, or the veterans that came out of the Vietnam War were the ones who really started public awareness toward the disabled. I really don't.
I know that you had been instrumental in talking to the people at the King of Prussia Mall and getting them to... I'm not quite sure what, but tell us a little bit about that. Who did you talk to and what did you facilitate there?
Well, what happened is that I was coming home from the King of Prussia Plaza one day, and I was just complaining of that to a neighbor of mine that this place was totally inaccessible, and I was really irritated. It was a rather warm day in March, believe it or not, and I don't know. I was just a little irritated. And I was complaining to her that, you know, it's a shame that this is the largest plaza in the Delaware Valley, and it's not accessible to people in wheelchairs. Not only that, I mean, they had curbs there that were so high that it was dangerous for the senior citizens, you know. So she said to me, she said, well, why don't you just write to the manager of the mall? I'm sure that he would respond to your reply. So I didn't really believe her. I says, oh, no, I don't think so. She said, well, it turned out that she was the secretary to the general manager. Right. So I decided to write to him, and I explained to him that the mall was totally inaccessible and there's no really good reason for it. And he responded. 2 days later, I got a letter from him. He said, well, great. I mean, not only did you tell me that the place was inaccessible, but you also were specific enough to point out the areas. Now tell me, what is it that I can do? So I said, don't go away. I sent him books concerning all the statistics, the specifications that he can do to build ramps, to widen doorways, to make bathrooms accessible. And he took the information and he went to work on it right away. And within 2 months' time, that man had that plaza totally accessible. And he won an award for it. Yeah, the following year. I mean, see, he had the plaza accessible in July, I think, of 1977. And in February of 1988, he was given the DIA, that's the Disabled in Action Award, for making for a barrier-free environment.
That's terrific.
Yeah, this young fella, he really is terrific. John McGuire. And I thought it was just a terrific thing that he did.
How's your car equipped?
Well, I have hand controls on my car, and... you know, many people think that the car comes specially built. That's not particularly true. What happens is that we have hand controls. The hand controls cost, well, anywhere between $100 and probably $200. And we buy them and we install them on a car. And we can take them off and install them on another car. As a matter of fact, the car that I have now is only a week old. Right? And I took the hand controls off my old car and I had them installed on this car. And so that's quite easy. I mean, now you can drive my car. I mean, an able-bodied person can drive the car with the hand controls on them.
So you have a control, the gas and the brakes are each controlled by one of your hands?
Right. I do all my driving with my hands. Right. There's kind of a long stick that comes out, and on that stick, I use that stick for the accelerator, for the brake, for the horn, for the high beam, the low beam, everything. It's very good. As a matter of fact, I enjoy driving this way more than I did when I was using my feet.
How's the gas rationing system?
As far as Jersey is concerned, I mean, Jersey is good with the handicapped. I mean, we can get the gas there anytime. Let me back up a little bit. I better start defining my terms here, because I know many people who are in wheelchairs don't like to use the word handicapped. They prefer the word disabled. I'm using it because I don't particularly care which word it is. And I'm saying that in case you have any listeners who happen to be in wheelchairs. I'm sure some of them certainly disagree with me on this, but I'll use any word, disabled or handicapped. Anyway, in New Jersey, they have people who are in wheelchairs can get gas at any time. Now, in Pennsylvania, I don't think they have that yet, but I think it's simply a matter of them becoming aware of it.
Let me ask you, Jim, you are paralyzed in your legs because of the time when you were 19, when you were jumped by a gang and stabbed. Now, I don't know what happened to these people. I don't know if you know what happened to them, but what are your feelings towards them? I mean, do you spend time thinking about revenge and about what you'd want to do?
Well, I did.
With them, if you could.
Let me say, I thought about revenge, I think, the first month after it happened, and that was back in 1951, and I don't think it lasted any more than a month. And I'm not trying to come across as a saint or a martyr or anything like that. It's just that my deepest feeling is that it's simply a waste of time. I was stabbed and I was paralyzed and all that stuff, but life is an ongoing thing. I mean, and I've tried to get my whole self in tune with life. And if I saw those fellas today, I wouldn't do anything. Now, as far as what's happening to them, what has happened to them, a few of them did serve time. The fellow who did the actual stabbing was never caught. Whether he has regretted what he's done or so forth, I don't know. I feel that if it would make him a better person, then he should do time. Maybe he has already become a better person as a result of it through his own conscience. I don't know, but if he has become a better person, then that's the way it goes, and let's just keep on moving toward the future. At least that's the way I feel about it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim McGowan, and what I'd like to do now, Jim, is just spend a little bit of time talking about a period of your career that I find really interesting. Okay. That's when you were singing with an R&B group in the 50s called the Four Fellows, and we happen to have an album here that has some of your tunes on it. And before we talk about this, Jim has, by the way, also just written a book about this period of music called Here Today, Gone Tomorrow. So before we talk about it, let's hear a tune sung by the Four Fellows, and Jim is the lead singer of this. This is the tune Soldier Boy, which was their hit in 1955 that spent some time being number one on the charts.
That's correct.
Okay, let's hear it.
Soldier Boy, what you do, don't you believe she will be true. It's written in the blue that she was meant for only you. Soldier boy, tell me why do you cry when you return? She runs to your side. It's written in the blue that she was meant for only you. So prove your love is true. She'll be there to say I do. Whoa. Go see your land, she'll make you understand why you're gone. Oh, try to believe her love for you is really for real. It's written in the blue that she was meant for only you. So proud your love is true. She'll be there to say I do. And if you go to your land, try to believe her love for you is really for real. it's written in the blue that she was meant for only you.
Soldier boy.
Recorded in 1955, the lead singer on that recording is my guest, Jim McGowan. And Jim was telling me while we were listening to that, I hadn't realized this, that Elvis Presley recorded that after he got out of the Army in about 1960.
That's right, 1960, around that time.
How did your group form, Jim?
Well, actually, we started singing in the storefront churches in Brooklyn during the 40s. I was a young kid then, maybe in my early teens, and gee, we just loved to sing, and the churches were... They were kind of an open arms, you know, they just welcomed us. You know, the young kids, they wanted to keep us off the streets and stuff like that. And so they just let us come in and sing, and they would give us a few pennies for singing. And that's how we started. And we kept this up, you know, as the years went by, we learned how to harmonize and so forth. And then in 1953, when I was recuperating from my original accident, some of the fellas that I sang in the storefront churches with came to me and said, "Come on, McGowan, let's sing some more." So, well, I had plenty of time on my hands, and so I started singing. And that's how we started, and sure enough, in 1955, we came up with Soldier Boy, which became one of the biggest records in the country at that time.
How did you hook up with a record company to get recorded in the first place?
Well, okay, we traveled up and down Broadway looking for a record company, and we went the whole route, you know, meeting with all kinds of agents and promoters, and many of them were corrupt, too. We went the whole route, you know. Finally, one day we did a freelance recording for a fellow who was a member of a popular band who was in the business of recording at that time. And a young man came to the studio to hear what we had done. And his name was Philip Rose. And he was starting his own record company. He was an A&R man for Derby Records at that time. And he heard my group and he liked us. And he was starting his own record company, and he decided to record us. And that's how we got with him. And he recorded us, and the very first song that we did on his label became a hit. And that very same man, Philip Rose, went on to produce several big Broadway plays.
Which ones?
A Raisin in the Sun, Owl and the Pussycat, Pearlie, Pearlie Victorious, Shenandoah. The list is endless, but he was our manager. And at the time that he met us and we met him, he was practically broke.
Do you know how he or whoever was responsible for it got your records the airplay that it obviously got?
Well, that's a very good question, too, because at the time that we became popular, Alan Freed, the biggest disc jockey in the country, probably the world, was handed our record.
By who?
By Philip Rose, my manager. And he made the statement. He said... I'll play this record only once. If it gets any responses, I'll play it again. If not, I will never play it again. And so he played it. And, you know, the story is that, of course, it became a hit. But that's how it happened. My manager took it to him. And these were the days of payola, unquote. So that's how it happens. I'm sure my manager didn't pay him anything. And this is the reason he made the statement. But the record had certain something that the people liked. And I think probably it was right. It was a post-war situation, you know, the post-Korean War. And it had a message that people were concerned with.
So when the record started taking off and you mm-hmm. became a hit group, what did you start doing? Were you touring? Were you playing a lot of dances?
Well, we toured. Now, let me give you a little bit of my own personal history so that we can fill this in. You see, I was paralyzed in 1951, but I regained the use of my legs to the extent that I was able to get around with crutches and canes, you see. I had youth on my side. I was truly paralyzed, but by some miracle, I did regain the use of my legs to the extent that I was able to get around with crutches and canes, and that enabled me to go on tour for a short period of time. So when the record became a hit in 1955, I was able to walk somewhat, but with a very terrible limp, and we appeared at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. That was our debut in 1955. And, of course, we were successful there, and then we went on tour. But shortly after we went on tour, my legs began to act up again. I actually had to be flown back to New York, and I was in the hospital then. As a matter of fact, I would say that my health was one of the big factors that broke up the group. But this is what happened. When the record became popular, We began working in nightclubs and in rock and roll shows and rhythm and blues shows and stuff like that.
Who were some of the people who we might know that you were in the company of then?
Well, we opened at the Apollo in the second week of June 1955, and that was our debut. And on that show was Bo Diddley. That was his debut. And the Nutmegs, a very popular group in rhythm and blues, that was their debut. I also worked with Chuck Berry. As a matter of fact, my record came out in April of 1955. Shortly after that, Chuck Berry had his very first record, which was Maybelline, which came out the very same year. Shortly after that, I'd say in August of 1955, the Platters, one of the biggest groups in rhythm and blues history, came out with their very first record. Well, the first hit record they had. They had one or two small records before that. They came out with Only You. So we started right about the same time. I also worked on the same show with Pat Boone, who many people don't realize got his start as a rhythm and blues. Well, he covered a lot
He covered all the rhythm and blues tunes.
Right.
He covered Tutti Frutti. And he covered Blue Suede Shoes, didn't he?
I don't think so. He covered Tutti Frutti, I'll Be Home, which was by the Flamingos. He covers a song by... Gosh, his list is endless. Unfortunately, I can't think of it. He covered Long Tall Sally, Pledging My Love by Johnny Ace. He started really as a cover artist of rhythm and blues songs. Tutti Frutti was one of his songs that he covered.
My recollections are that in the 50s and the early 60s, almost everyone wanted to have an R&B group. Almost everyone wanted to sing in an R&B group.
That's
It's just really true that there were people all over on the street corner singing. And mm-hmm. In the bathrooms in high school, everybody was always singing there too.
That's where we started.
I guess a lot of people came up to you then and always wanted advice about how to make it.
Yeah, we had quite a few people asking like that. And you know, I'll tell you something. We started, like I said, we were in the storefront churches. And the storefront churches really was a proving ground because we didn't just go in there and sing. I mean, the competition that was in the storefront churches was tremendous. You had to really be good. And because the groups were severely critical of those who were not. When you sang in the churches, your harmony had better be right. Unfortunately, when rhythm and blues became very popular, when the guys and girls who were singing in the storefront churches started singing rhythm and blues, and it became very popular, the record companies and the promotion men began to grab people off the street corners and out of the schoolyards who really didn't have that church training, you see. And I tend to feel that the quality of some of the singing dropped. I mean, some of the harmony dropped because it became so commercial that they were just grabbing people who didn't have to prove themselves in the storefront churches. And you take most of the groups who began their early singing in the storefront churches, at least I think they had better harmony, you know?
What happened to some of the people who you sang with in the Four Fellows? Did they go on to different music groups?
Yeah, well, that's interesting because one of the fellows who sang in my group, the baritone, Larry Banks, he is the writer of Go Now, which was the biggest hit that the Rooney Blues ever had. And his wife, Bessie Banks, she was the original recorder of Go Now. She recorded Go Now, I don't know what year it came out, and it became popular in England. And then the Moody Blues heard it, and they recorded it. And, of course, it was voted by BMI as being the most popular song in the world. So he was responsible for that. He's also done several other recordings. As I mentioned earlier, David Jones, the fellow who wrote Soulja Boy, the one that we had our hit over, he sang with the Rays, and the Rays recorded Silhouettes, and that was a very big hit. Incidentally, the guy who sang the lead in Silhouettes also sang with me when we were a group called the Four Toppers. The bass who sang with the Four Fellows, he now is a motorman on the A-Train in Manhattan. That runs between Brooklyn and Manhattan. So on May 11th of last month, last month, May 11th, we got together for the first time in 23 years. So this is what happened to us.
Did you sing?
We did. I'll tell you, we sang a spiritual. And I thought that was significant and symbolic, too, because, for instance, we began our singing spirituals. And the first time we were together in 23 years, I mean, that was the first time that I had actually seen two of the fellows in 23 years. we decided that, you know, it was 800 people there, and they asked us to sing, and we just didn't know what to sing or whether we could really sing it again. But anyway, we did sing the spiritual, and I thought that that was very, you know, symbolic too, because we started out singing spirituals.
Do you have the original 45s of the tunes that are on the album that you brought with you today?
Unfortunately, no, and this is one of the reasons I'm happy for this album, because without it, I wouldn't know where to begin to collect our records. I mean, after we started out with the intentions of being a pop group, not a rhythm and blues group. We wanted to be like the Mills Brothers, and my attitude was, after I recorded the songs, I turned my back on them and just simply walked away from them. I look back on them now, and of course, I like them, and I feel that I'm happy that we did them. But originally, you know, I just turned my back on them. But now that we have them, I'm happy that we have them.
Let's hear another tune sung by the Four Fellows. And again, my guest Jim McGowan was the lead singer of this group. And we're going to hear a tune called Angels Say. Would you want to say a few words about it before we hear it?
Yes, this is one of the songs that I actually wrote. Yeah, I wrote Angels Say, and I was just musing. I was recovering from my injury, just looking out of the window, just kind of daydreaming, feeling sorry for myself. And I wrote the song, and I had no idea that we were going to ever record it one day, but we did.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
Angels say there's a place all the way in the sky, where there's a lover's rendezvous, up in the blue, for you and I. We'll go to that place in the sky someday, and nothing
Say, written by my guest Jim McGowan, sung by the Four Fellows, the group in which Jim was the lead singer, and that was recorded in the mid-1950s. Jim, I'd like to just talk a little bit about another aspect of the work that you've done, and that's wheelchair sports. Mm-hmm. And you've played it, you've organized a very large wheelchair sports event that was held in the Delaware Valley, mm-hmm. which you also hosted, and you've also done the photography for a book that is called Wheelchair Champions, A History mm-hmm. of Wheelchair Sports. Usually, when people talk about wheelchair sports who don't participate, it's usually a very sarcastic comment about wheelchair races.
Mm-hmm.
Who shows up for wheelchair sports events? What kind of audiences do they have now?
Well, I tell you, they have audience consisting of both able-bodied and disabled people. And it's people who really, I think, have a healthy interest in trying to find out what the disabled is all about. What is it that they can do? So these are the kind of people that show up at wheelchair sporting events, and I think it's good. And I promoted several wheelchair sporting events, and I'm using wheelchair sports as a means of getting people to understand the disabled. And I think it's a fantastic area to get to understand people who are disabled.
What's the spirit of the game, if you could generalize about mm-hmm. that? Are these events usually very competitive, or is it more a question of the process involved?
Well, they started out as therapy, but they have become highly competitive. As a matter of fact, wheelchair sporting events are carried on in many, many countries throughout the world. Wherever you find the regular Olympics, that's where you find the Special Olympics, that is wheelchair sports, too. So they're highly competitive. I mean, there's gold medals that are being offered and so forth. Wheelchair athletes are proving themselves to be some of the most outstanding athletes in the world, and that's no exaggeration.
I think frequently people are particularly gentle or try to be mm-hmm. around people who are in wheelchairs because mm-hmm. it's just a little disorienting and you right. really want to make sure that you don't mm-hmm. do anything you shouldn't be doing. Right. I bet in wheelchair sports events people are really aggressive and mm-hmm. kind of rough.
That's
sure, people
true.
Knock into each other all the time.
Mm-hmm. I think the general public
fall out of their chairs.
That's right. The general public is shocked when they see their first wheelchair sporting event. Wheelchair athletes are some of the toughest athletes in the world. Let me give you an example. You know, the world's record in weightlifting is held by a disabled athlete.
Really?
Eddie Coyle from Reliance Down actually has outlifted every man in the world. And this man has polio. I mean, he has to walk with braces. And I can go on and on and on. Wheelchair athletes are truly tough. People who are disabled, who find themselves in physical bodies that have great limitations, find themselves using more energy. And as a result of it, they have done things that usually people who are able-bodied have not been able to do. So people who are disabled really are tough. They're able. I mean, one of the greatest thrills that I had when I started playing wheelchair sports, believe it or not, was actually falling out of the chair. I mean, the feeling of knowing that my body was once again involved in the rough and tough tumble of sports again. It's really a great feeling. And so for people to come to a wheelchair sporting event and feel that they have to be careful, that's human. We don't blame them for that. I mean, they're not familiar with it. It's due only to the fact that they don't know. But once they become familiar with it, then they realize.
This may sound silly, but you're talking to mm-hmm. a lot of able-bodied people and some people mm-hmm. who are also disabled who are probably listening in wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. Are there a couple of things that you'd really want to tell people who are able-bodied mm-hmm. about how to how they might be more comfortable in the presence of people who are in chairs or uh-huh. how to make people in chairs more comfortable instead of relying on on them uh-huh. to, you know,
yes,
give them
I
all kinds
so.
Of cues and relying on the people in the wheelchairs to put the able-bodied people at ease?
Uh-huh. Well, I think it's something of an art that they have to develop, and that is that they have to understand, number one, that the person who is disabled is disabled. At the same time, they have to be able to treat the disabled person in every way normal as they possibly can. And that requires an art because you're dealing with basically two diametrically opposite situations here. You got a person who is disabled, and you have to treat them as if they're able, yet at the same time realize that they are disabled. And this, if they can acquire this, then they're going to be successful. At the same time, the onus is not only on the person who is able-bodied, the onus is also on the person who is disabled. He has to realize, or she has to realize, that she is disabled and that she has certain limitations. At the same time, she has to do as much as she possibly can that able-bodied people do. So, I mean, this it requires a certain art in doing this here.
Jim, what are some of the things that are in your future?
Well, right now, submitted my book on the focal group to a publisher, and I'm hoping that that comes through. At the same time, I would like to pursue a postgraduate career in special education. And then I'd like to get out and see what the rest of the world is doing.
Well, I wish you the best in the world. Thank you very much for being here this afternoon.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Terry, I assure you.
My guest has been Jim McGowan, and we've been talking a little bit about disabilities. Jim is paralyzed in the legs and himself is in a wheelchair. Let me tell you a little bit else about him. He's also written a book on Thomas Garrett, who was a resident of Wilmington, who made his house into a stop on the Underground Railroad. He's just completed a book on rhythm and blues of the 1950s, and he's also a cytotechnologist. And we're going to listen now to another tune from the group that he sang with in the 1950s, a group called the Four Fellows, of which he was the lead singer. And we're going to hear a tune called I Sit in My Window. Jim, thanks again for being here.
Thank you, Terry. My pleasure.
I sit in my window wishing for you. Where did you roam, leaving me alone? Tell me, what did I do? I sit in my window with tears in my eyes. You went away and didn't even once, not once, say goodbye. We vowed to love each other, told everyone in town there would be no other. Swore that we would never want another down. I sit in my window both night and day. What could it be? I just can't see why you went away. Love each other, told everyone in town there would be no other. We swore that we would never put one another down. I sit in my window both night and day. What could it be? I just can't see why you went away.
Four Fellows, with Jim McGowan doing the lead singing on that.